This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Better Than Before, Mastering the Habits of Our Everyday Lives. This is the author, Gretchen Rubin. The greatest of empires is the empire over one's self. Publius Syrus. A note to the listener. Better Than Before tackles the question, how do we change? One answer, by using habits. Habits are the invisible architecture of daily life. We repeat about 40% of our behavior almost daily, so our habits shape our existence and our future. If we change our habits, we change our lives. But that observation just raises another question. Okay, then, how do we change our habits? That's what this book seeks to answer. But while Better Than Before explores how to change your habits, it won't tell you what particular habits to form. It won't tell you to exercise first thing in the morning, or to eat dessert twice a week, or to clear out your office. Well, actually, there is one area where I do say what habit I think is best, but only one. The fact is, no one-size-fits-all solution exists. It's easy to dream that if we copy the habits of productive, creative people, we'll win similar success. But we each must cultivate the habits that work for us. Some people do better when they start small. Others when they start big. Some people need to be held accountable. Some defy accountability. Some thrive when they give themselves an occasional break from their good habits. Others when they never break the chain. No wonder habit formation is so hard. The most important thing is to know ourselves and to choose the strategies that work for us. Before you begin, identify a few habits that you'd like to adopt or changes you'd like to make. Then, as you read, consider what steps you want to try. You may even want to note today's date so you'll remember when you began the process of change. To help you shape your habits, I regularly post suggestions on my blog, and I've also created many resources to help you make your life better than before. But I hope that the most compelling inspiration is the book you're listening to. I see habits through the lens of my own experience, so this account is colored by my particular personality and interests. Well, you might think, if everyone forms habits differently, why should I bother to read a book about what someone else did? During my study of habits and happiness, I've noticed something surprising. I often learn more from one person's idiosyncratic experiences than I do from scientific studies or philosophical treatises. For this reason, Better Than Before is packed with individual examples of habit changes. You may not be tempted by Nutella, or travel too much for work, or struggle to keep a gratitude journal, but we can all learn from each other. It's simple to change habits, but it's not easy. I hope that listening to Better Than Before will encourage you to harness the power of habits to make change in your own life. Whenever you listen to this, and wherever you are, you're in the right place to begin. Decide not to decide. Introduction. It is a profoundly erroneous truism that we should cultivate the habit of thinking of what we are doing. The precise opposite is the case. Civilization advances by extending the number of operations we can perform without thinking about them. Alfred North Whitehead, An Introduction to Mathematics. For as long as I can remember, one of my favorite features in any book, magazine, play, or TV show has been the before and after. Whenever I read those words, I'm hooked. The thought of a transformation, any kind of transformation, thrills me. Whether the change is as important as quitting smoking or as trivial as reorganizing a desk, I love to read about how and why someone made that change. Before and after caught my imagination, and it also provoked my curiosity. Sometimes people can make dramatic changes, but more often, they can't. Why or why not? As a writer, my great interest is human nature, and in particular, the subject of happiness. A few years ago, I noticed a pattern. When people told me about a before and after change they made that boosted their happiness, they often pointed to the formation of a crucial habit. And when they were unhappy about a change they'd failed to make, that too often related to a habit. Then one day, when I was having lunch with an old friend, she said something that turned my casual interest in habits into a full-time preoccupation. After we'd looked at our menus, she remarked, "I want to get myself in the habit of exercise, but I can't, and it really bothers me." Then, in a brief observation that would absorb me for a long time to come, she added, "The weird thing is that in high school, I was on the track team, and I never missed track practice, but I can't go running now. Why?" "Why?" I echoed, as I mentally flipped through my index cards of happiness research to find some relevant insight or useful explanation. Nothing. Our conversation shifted to other topics, but as the days passed, I couldn't get this exchange out of my mind. Same person, same activity, different habit. Why? Why had she been able to exercise faithfully in the past, but not now? How might she start again? Her question buzzed in my head with the special energy that tells me I've stumbled onto something important. Finally, I connected that conversation with what I'd noticed about people's accounts of their before and after transformations, and it struck me. To understand how people are able to change, I must understand habits. I felt the sense of joyous anticipation and relief that I feel every time I get the idea for my next book. It was obvious. Habits. Whenever I become gripped by a subject, I read everything related to it, so I began to plunder the shelves in cognitive science, behavioral economics, monastic governance, philosophy, psychology, product design, addiction, consumer research, productivity, animal training, decision science, public policy, and the design of kindergarten rooms and routines. A tremendous amount of information about habits was floating around, but I had to divide the astronomy from the astrology. I spent a lot of time delving into treatises, histories, biographies, and in particular, the latest scientific research. At the same time, I've learned to put great store in my own observations of everyday life, because while laboratory experiments are one way to study human nature, they aren't the only way. I'm a kind of street scientist. I spend most of my time trying to grasp the obvious, not to see what no one has seen, but to see what's in plain sight. A sentence will jump off the page, or someone's casual comment, like my friend's remark about the track team, will strike me as highly significant for reasons that I don't quite understand. Then, as I learn more, these loose puzzle pieces begin to fit together until the picture becomes clear. The more I learned about habits, the more interested I became, but I also became increasingly frustrated. To my surprise, the sources I consulted made little mention of many of the issues that struck me as most crucial. Perhaps it's understandable why it's hard to form a habit we don't enjoy, but why is it hard to form a habit we do enjoy? Sometimes people acquire habits overnight, and sometimes they drop long-time habits just as abruptly. Why? Why do some people dread and resist habits, while others adopt them eagerly? Why do so many successful dieters regain their lost weight, plus more? Why are people so often unmoved by the consequences of their habits? For instance, 1/3 to 1/2 of U.S. patients don't take medicine prescribed for a chronic illness. Do the same strategies work for changing simple habits, wearing a seatbelt, and for complex habits, drinking less? Why is it that sometimes, though we're very anxious, even desperate, to change a habit, we can't? A friend told me, "I have health issues and I feel lousy when I eat certain foods, but I eat them anyway." Do the same habit formation strategies apply equally well to everyone? Certain situations seem to make it easier to form habits. Which ones and why? I was determined to find the answers to those questions and to figure out every aspect of how habits are made and broken. Habits were the key to understanding how people were able to change. But why did habits make it possible for people to change? I found the answer in part in a few sentences whose dry, calm words disguised an observation that, for me, was explosively interesting. Researchers were surprised to find, write Roy Baumeister and John Tierney in their fascinating book, Willpower, that people with strong self-control spent less time resisting desires than other people did. People with good self-control mainly use it not for rescue in emergencies, but rather to develop effective habits and routines in school and at work. In other words, habits eliminate the need for self-control. Self-control is a crucial aspect of our lives. People with better self-control, or self-regulation, self-discipline, or willpower, are happier and healthier. They're more altruistic. They have stronger relationships and more career success. They manage stress and conflict better. They live longer. They steer clear of bad habits. Self-control allows us to keep our commitments to ourselves. Yet one study suggests that when we try to use self-control to resist temptation, we succeed only about half the time. And indeed, in a large international survey, when people were asked to identify their failings, a top choice was lack of self-control. There's some debate about the nature of self-control. Some argue that we have a limited amount of self-control strength, and as we exert it, we exhaust it. Others counter that willpower isn't limited in this way, and that we can find fresh reserves by reframing our actions. As for me, I wake up with a reasonable store of self-control, and the more I draw on it, the lower it drops. I remember sitting in a meeting and resisting a cookie plate for an hour, then grabbing two cookies on my way out. And that's why habits matter so much. With habits, we conserve our self-control. Because we're in the habit of putting a dirty coffee cup in the office dishwasher, we don't need self-control to perform that action. We do it without thinking. Of course, it takes self-control to establish good habits. But once the habit is in place, we can effortlessly do the things we want to do. And there's one reason in particular that habits help to preserve our self-control. In ordinary terms, a habit is generally defined as a behavior that's recurrent, is cued by a specific context, often happens without much awareness or conscious intent, and is acquired through frequent repetition. I became convinced, however, that the defining aspect of habits isn't frequency or repetition or the familiarity of the cues for particular behavior. These factors do matter, but in the end, I concluded that the real key to habits is decision-making. Or more accurately, the lack of decision-making. A habit requires no decision from me because I've already decided. Am I going to brush my teeth when I wake up? Am I going to take this pill? I decide, then I don't decide. Mindfully, then mindlessly. I shouldn't worry about making healthy choices. I should make one healthy choice and then stop choosing. This freedom from decision-making is crucial. Because when I have to decide, which often involves resisting temptation or postponing gratification, I tax my self-control. I'd asked myself, why do habits make it possible for people to change? And now I knew the answer. Habits make change possible by freeing us from decision-making and from using self-control. One day, after checking the time difference to make sure that it wasn't too early in Los Angeles, I called my sister Elizabeth to talk to her about my research. She's 5 years younger than I am, but I call her my sister the sage because she always has tremendous insight into whatever I'm pondering at the moment. After we talked about my nephew Jack's most recent antics and the latest news about the TV show that Elizabeth writes for, I told her how preoccupied I'd become with the subject of habits. "I think I figured out why habits are so important," I told her. As I explained my conclusions, I could picture her sitting at her crowded desk, dressed in her unvarying outfit of running shoes, jeans, and hoodie. With habits, we don't make decisions. We don't use self-control. We just do the thing we want ourselves to do, or that we don't want to do. Does that sound right to you? "That sounds about right," said Elizabeth agreeably. She's used to hearing me talk about my obsessions. But here's another question. How do people compare to each other? Some people love habits, and some people hate them. For some people, habits come fairly easily. Other people struggle much more. Why? You should start by figuring that out about yourself. You love habits more than anyone I know. When I hung up the phone, I realized that, as usual, Elizabeth had supplied me with a key insight. I hadn't quite understood this truth about myself before she pointed it out. I'm a wholehearted habits embracer. I love to cultivate habits, and the more I learn about them, the more I've come to recognize their many benefits. When possible, the brain makes a behavior into a habit, which saves effort, and therefore gives us more capacity to deal with complex, novel, or urgent matters. Habits mean we don't strain ourselves to make decisions, weigh choices, dole out rewards, or prod ourselves to begin. Life becomes simpler, and many daily hassles vanish. Because I don't have to think about the multi-step process of putting in my contact lenses, I can think about the logistical problems posed by the radiator leak in my home office. Also, when we're worried or overtaxed, a habit comforts us. Research suggests that people feel more in control and less anxious when engaged in habit behavior. I have a long blue jacket that I wore for 2 years straight whenever I gave speeches, and now it's quite tired looking. Yet if I feel particularly anxious about some presentation, I still turn to that well-worn jacket. Surprisingly, stress doesn't necessarily make us likely to indulge in bad habits. When we're anxious or tired, we fall back on our habits, whether bad or good. In one study, students in the habit of eating a healthy breakfast were more likely to eat healthfully during exams, while students in the habit of eating an unhealthy breakfast were more likely to eat unhealthfully. For this reason, it's all the more important to try to shape habits mindfully, so that when we fall back on them at times of stress, we're following activities that make our situation better, not worse. But habits, even good habits, have drawbacks as well as benefits. Habits speed time, because when every day is the same, experience shortens and blurs. By contrast, time slows down when habits are interrupted, when the brain must process new information. That's why the first month at a new job seems to last longer than the fifth year at that job. And as it speeds time, habit also deadens. An early morning cup of coffee was delightful the first few times, until it gradually became part of the background of my day. Now I don't really taste it, but I'm frantic if I don't get it. Habit makes it dangerously easy to become numb to our own existence. For good and bad, habits are the invisible architecture of daily life. Research suggests that about 40% of our behavior is repeated almost daily, and mostly in the same context. I bet my own percentage is higher. I wake up at the same time every day. I give my husband, Jamie, a good morning kiss at the same time. I wear the same outfit of running shoes, yoga pants, and white t-shirt. I work at my laptop in the same places every day. I walk the same routes around my New York City neighborhood. I work on my email at the same time. I put my daughters, 13-year-old Eliza and 7-year-old Eleanor, to bed in the same unchanging sequence. When I ask myself, why is my life the way it is today? I see that it has been shaped, to a great degree, by my habits. As architect Christopher Alexander described it, if I consider my life honestly, I see that it is governed by a certain very small number of patterns of events which I take part in over and over again. Being in bed, having a shower, having breakfast in the kitchen, sitting in my study writing, walking in the garden, cooking and eating our common lunch at my office with my friends, going to the movies, taking my family to eat at a restaurant, having a drink at a friend's house, driving on the freeway, going to bed again. There are a few more. There are surprisingly few of these patterns of events in any one person's way of life, perhaps no more than a dozen. Look at your own life and you will find the same. It is shocking at first to see that there are so few patterns of events open to me. Not that I want more of them, But when I see how very few of them there are, I begin to understand what a huge effect these few patterns have on my life, on my capacity to live. If these few patterns are good for me, I can live well. If they are bad for me, I can't. In the area of health alone, our unthinking actions may have profound effect. Poor diet, inactivity, smoking, and drinking are among the leading causes of illness and death in the United States, and these are health habits within our control. In many ways, our habits are our destiny. And changing our habits allows us to alter that destiny. Generally, I've observed, we seek changes that fall into the essential seven. People, including me, most want to foster the habits that will allow them to 1. Eat and drink more healthfully. Give up sugar. Eat more vegetables. Drink less alcohol. 2. Exercise regularly. 3. Save, spend, and earn wisely. Save regularly. Pay down debt. Donate to worthy causes. Stick to a budget. 4. Rest, relax, and enjoy. Stop watching TV in bed. Turn off a cell phone. Spend time in nature. Cultivate silence. Get enough sleep. Spend less time in the car. 5. Accomplish more. Stop procrastinating. Practice an instrument. Work without interruption. Learn a language. Maintain a blog. 6. Simplify, clear, clean, and organize. Make the bed. File regularly. Put keys away in the same place. Recycle. 7. Engage more deeply in relationships with other people, with God, with the world. Call friends, volunteer, have more sex, spend more time with family, attend religious services. The same habit can satisfy different needs. A morning walk in the park might be a form of exercise, 2, a way to rest and enjoy, 4, or, in the company of a friend, a way to engage more deeply in a relationship, 7. And people value different habits. For one person, organized files are a crucial tool for creativity. Another finds inspiration in unexpected juxtapositions. The essential seven reflect the fact that we often feel both tired and wired. We feel exhausted, but also feel jacked up on adrenaline, caffeine, and sugar. We feel frantically busy, but also feel that we're not spending enough time on the things that really matter. I wasn't going to bed on time, but I wasn't staying up late talking to friends, either. I was watching a midnight episode of The Office that I know by heart. I wasn't typing up my work notes or reading a novel, but mindlessly scrolling through the addictive People You May Know section on LinkedIn. Slowly, as my research proceeded, my ideas about habits began to take a more coherent shape. Habits make change possible, I'd concluded, by freeing us from decision-making and from using self-control. That notion led to another key issue. If habits make it possible for us to change, how exactly, then, do we shape our habits? That enormous question became my subject. First, I settled on some basic definitions and questions. In my studies, I would embrace a generous conception of the term habit to reflect how people use the term in everyday life. I'm in the habit of going to the gym, or I want to improve my eating habits. A routine is a string of habits, and a ritual is a habit charged with transcendent meaning. I wouldn't attempt to tackle addictions, compulsions, disorders, or nervous habits, or to explain the neuroscience of habits. I was only mildly interested in understanding how my brain lights up when I see a cinnamon raisin bagel. And while some might argue that it's unhelpful to label habits as good or bad, I decided to use the colloquial term good habit for any habit I want to cultivate, and bad habit for one I want to squelch. My main focus would be the methods of habit change. From my giant trove of notes about habits, detailing the research I'd examined, the examples I'd witnessed, and the advice I'd read, I'd discern all the various strategies that we can use to change a habit. It's odd. Most discussions of habit change champion a single approach, as if one approach could work for everyone. Hard experience proves that this assumption isn't true. If only there were one simple cookie-cutter answer. But I knew that different people need different solutions, so I aimed to identify every possible option. Because self-knowledge is indispensable to successful habit formation, the first section of the book, Self-Knowledge, would explore the two strategies that help us to understand ourselves, four tendencies and distinctions. Next would come the pillars of habits, the section that would examine the well-known essential strategies of monitoring, foundation, scheduling, and accountability. The section, the best time to begin, would consider the particular importance of the time of beginning when forming a habit, as explored in the strategies of first steps, clean slate, and lightning bolt. Next, the section, desire, ease, and excuses, would take into account our desires to avoid effort and experience pleasure, which play a role in the strategies of abstaining, convenience, inconvenience, safeguards, loophole spotting, distraction, reward, treats, and pairing. Loophole spotting is the funniest strategy. Finally, the section, unique, just like everyone else, would investigate the strategies that arise from our drive to understand and define ourselves in the context of other people, in the strategies of clarity, identity, and other people. Once I'd identified these strategies, I wanted to experiment with them. The twin riddles of how to change ourselves and how to change our habits have vexed mankind throughout the ages. If I was going to try to figure out the answers, I'd have to fortify my analysis with my own experience as guinea pig. Only by putting my theories to the test would I understand what works. But when I told a friend that I was studying habits and planned to try out several new habits, he protested, "You should fight habits, not encourage them." "Are you kidding? I love my habits," I said. "No willpower, no agonizing, like brushing my teeth." "Not me," my friend said. "Habits make me feel trapped." I remain firmly pro-habits, but this conversation was an important reminder. Habit is a good servant, but a bad master. Although I wanted the benefits that habits offer, I didn't want to become a bureaucrat of my own life, trapped in paperwork of my own making. As I worked on my habits, I should pursue only those habits that would make me feel freer and stronger. I should keep asking myself, to what end do I pursue this habit? It was essential that my habits suit me, because I can build a happy life only on the foundation of my own nature. And if I wanted to try to help other people shape their habits, a notion that I had to admit appealed to me, their habits would have to suit them. One night, as we were getting ready for bed, I was recounting highlights from my day's habit research to Jamie. He'd had a tough day at work and looked weary and preoccupied, but suddenly he started laughing. "What?" I asked. "With your books about happiness, you were trying to answer the question, how do I become happier? And this habits book is, no, seriously, how do I become happier?" "You're right," I replied. "It was really true. So many people tell me, I know what would make me happier, but I can't make myself do what it takes. Habits are the solution." When we change our habits, we change our lives. We can use decision-making to choose the habits we want to form. We can use willpower to get the habits started. Then, and this is the best part, we can allow the extraordinary power of habit to take over. We take our hands off the wheel of decision, our foot off the gas of willpower, and rely on the cruise control of habits. That's the promise of habit. For a happy life, it's important to cultivate an atmosphere of growth, the sense that we're learning new things, getting stronger, forging new relationships, making things better, helping other people. Habits have a tremendous role to play in creating an atmosphere of growth because they help us make consistent, reliable progress. Perfection may be an impossible goal, but habits help us to do better. Making headway toward a good habit, doing better than before, saves us from facing the end of another year with the mournful wish, once again, that we'd done things differently. Habit is notorious, and rightly so, for its ability to control our actions, even against our will. By mindfully choosing our habits, we harness the power of mindlessness as a sweeping force for serenity, energy, and growth. Better than before. It's what we all want. Self-knowledge. To shape our habits successfully, we must know ourselves. We can't presume that if a habit formation strategy works for one person, it will work just as well for anyone else, because people are very different from each other. This section covers two strategies that allow us to identify important aspects of our habit nature, the four tendencies, and distinctions. These observational strategies don't require that we change what we're doing, only that we learn to see ourselves accurately. The fateful tendencies we bring into the world. The four tendencies. It is only when you meet someone of a different culture from yourself that you begin to realize what your own beliefs really are. George Orwell, The Road to Wigan Pier. I knew exactly where my extended investigation of habits would begin. For years, I've kept a list of my secrets of adulthood, which are the lessons I've learned with time and experience. Some are serious, such as, just because something is fun for someone else doesn't mean it's fun for me. And some are goofy, such as, food tastes better when I eat with my hands. One of my most important secrets of adulthood, however, is I'm more like other people and less like other people than I suppose. While I'm not much different from other people, those differences are very important. For this reason, the same habit strategies don't work for everyone. If we know ourselves, we're able to manage ourselves better, and if we're trying to work with others, it helps to understand them. So I would start with self-knowledge by identifying how my nature affects my habits. Figuring that out, however, isn't easy. As novelist John Updike observed, surprisingly few clues are ever offered us as to what kind of people we are. In my research, I'd looked for a good framework to explain differences in how people respond to habits. But to my surprise, none existed. Was I the only one who wondered why some people adopt habits much more or less readily than other people? Or why some people dread habits? Or why some people are able to keep certain habits in certain situations, but not others? I couldn't figure out the pattern. Then one afternoon, eureka. The answer didn't emerge from my library research, but from my preoccupation with the question my friend had asked me. I'd been pondering, yet again, her simple observation. She'd never miss practice for her high school track team, but she can't make herself go running now. Why? As my idea hit, I felt the same excitement that Archimedes must have felt when he stepped into his bath. Suddenly, I grasped it. The first and most important habits question is, how does a person respond to an expectation? When we try to form a new habit, we set an expectation for ourselves. Therefore, it's crucial to understand how we respond to expectations. We face two kinds of expectations. Outer expectations, meet work deadlines, observe traffic regulations, and inner expectations, stop napping, keep a New Year's resolution. From my observation, just about everyone falls into one of four distinct groups. Upholders respond readily to both outer expectations and inner expectations. Questioners question all expectations and will meet an expectation only if they believe it's justified. Obligers respond readily to outer expectations, but struggle to meet inner expectations. My friend on the track team. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. As I struggled to find a name for this framework, one of my favorite passages from Sigmund Freud's The Theme of the Three Caskets floated into my head. Freud explains that the names of the three goddesses of fate mean the accidental within the decrees of destiny, the inevitable, and the fateful tendencies each one of us brings into the world. The fateful tendencies each one of us brings into the world. I decided to name my framework the four tendencies. The four fateful tendencies, though accurate, sounded a little melodramatic. As I developed the framework of the four tendencies, I truly felt as though I were discovering the periodic table of the elements of character. I wasn't making up a system, I was uncovering a law of nature. Or perhaps I'd created a habits sorting hat. Our tendency colors the way we see the world, and therefore has enormous consequences for our habits. Of course, these are tendencies, but I've found, to a degree that surprises me, that most people do fall squarely into one camp. And once I identified the tendencies, I got a kick from hearing the people within a given tendency make the same kinds of comments over and over. Questioners, for example, often remark on how much they hate to wait in line. Upholders. Upholders respond readily to outer expectations and inner expectations. They wake up and think, what's on the schedule and the to-do list for today? They want to know what's expected of them and to meet those expectations. They avoid making mistakes or letting people down, including themselves. Others can rely on upholders, and upholders can rely on themselves. They're self-directed and have little trouble meeting commitments, keeping resolutions, or meeting deadlines. They often finish early. They want to understand the rules, and they often search for the rules beyond the rules, as in the case of art or ethics. One friend with an upholder wife told me, if something is on the schedule, my wife is going to do it. When we were in Thailand, we'd planned to visit a certain temple, and we went, even though she got food poisoning the night before and was throwing up on her way there. Because upholders feel a real obligation to meet their expectations for themselves, they have a strong instinct for self-preservation, and this helps protect them from their tendency to meet others' expectations. I need a lot of time for myself, an upholder friend told me, to exercise, to kick around new ideas for work, to listen to music. If people ask me to do things that interfere, it's easy for me to tell them no. However, upholders may struggle in situations where expectations aren't clear or the rules aren't established. They may feel compelled to meet expectations, even ones that seem pointless. They may feel uneasy when they know they're breaking the rules, even unnecessary rules, unless they work out a powerful justification to do so. This is my tendency. I'm an upholder. My upholder tendency sometimes makes me overly concerned with following the rules. Years ago, when I pulled out my laptop to work in a coffee shop, the barista told me, "You can't use a laptop in here." Now, every time I go to a new coffee shop, I worry about whether I can use my laptop. There's a relentless quality to upholders, too. I'm sure it's tiresome for Jamie. Sometimes it's even tiresome for me to hear my alarm go off every morning at 6 o'clock. I have an upholder friend who estimates that she skips going to the gym only about 6 times a year. How does your family feel about that? I asked. Well, my husband used to complain. Now he's used to it. Although I love being an upholder, I see its dark side, too. The gold star seeking, the hoop jumping, the sometimes mindless rule following. When I figured out that I was an upholder, I understood why I'd been drawn to the study of habits. We upholders find it relatively easy to cultivate habits. It's not easy, but it's easier than for many other people. And we embrace them because we find them gratifying. But the fact that even habit-loving upholders must struggle to foster good habits shows how challenging it is to form habits. Questioners. Questioners question all expectations, and they respond to an expectation only if they conclude that it makes sense. They're motivated by reason, logic, and fairness. They wake up and think, what needs to get done today and why? They decide for themselves whether a course of action is a good idea, and they resist doing anything that seems to lack sound purpose. Essentially, they turn all expectations into inner expectations. As one questioner wrote on my blog, I refuse to follow arbitrary rules. I jaywalk as long as there are no cars coming, and I'll go through a red light if it's the middle of the night and there's no other traffic in sight. But rules that I find based in morality, ethics, reason are very compelling. A friend said, why don't I take my vitamins? My doctor tells me I should, but usually I don't. She's a questioner, so I asked, do you believe that you need to take vitamins? Well, no, she answered after a pause. As a matter of fact, I don't. I bet you'd take them if you thought they mattered. Questioners resist rules for rules' sake. A reader posted on my blog, my son's school principal said that kids were expected to tuck in their shirts. When I expressed surprise at the seemingly arbitrary rule, the principal said that the school had many rules just for the sake of teaching children to follow rules. That's a dumb reason to ask anyone, including children, to follow a rule. If we know of such rules, we should seek and destroy them to make the world a better place. Because questioners like to make well-considered decisions and come to their own conclusions, they're very intellectually engaged, and they're often willing to do exhaustive research. If they decide there's sufficient basis for an expectation, they'll follow it. If not, they won't. Another questioner said, my wife is annoyed with me because she really wants us both to track our spending. But we're not in debt. We spend within our means, so I don't think that getting that information is worth the hassle. So I won't do it. Questioners resist anything that seems arbitrary. For instance, questioners often remark, I can keep a resolution if I think it's important, but I wouldn't make a New Year's resolution because January 1st is a meaningless date. At times, the questioner's appetite for information and justification can become overwhelming. My mother makes me insane, one reader reported, because she expects me to need tons of information the way she does. She constantly asks questions that I didn't ask, wouldn't ask, and generally don't think I need to know the answers to. Questioners themselves sometimes wish they could accept expectations without probing them so relentlessly. A questioner told me ruefully, I suffer from analysis paralysis. I always want to have one more piece of information. Questioners are motivated by sound reasons, or at least what they believe to be sound reasons. In fact, questioners can sometimes seem like crackpots, because they may reject expert opinion in favor of their own conclusions. They ignore those who say, why do you think you know more about cancer than your doctor? Or, everyone prepares the report one way. Why do you insist on your own crazy format? Questioners come in two flavors. Some questioners have an inclination to uphold, and others have an inclination to rebel, like being Virgo with Scorpio rising. My husband, Jamie, questions everything, but it's not too hard to persuade him to uphold. As an upholder, I doubt I could be married happily to someone who wasn't an upholder or a questioner slash upholder, which is a sobering thought. If questioners believe that a particular habit is worthwhile, they'll stick to it, but only if they're satisfied about the habit's usefulness. Obligers. Obligers meet outer expectations, but struggle to meet inner expectations. They're motivated by external accountability. They wake up and think, "What must I do today?" Because obligers excel at meeting external demands and deadlines and go to great lengths to meet their responsibilities, they make terrific colleagues, family members, and friends, which I know firsthand because my mother and my sister are both obligers. Because obligers resist inner expectations, it's difficult for them to self-motivate, to work on a PhD thesis, to attend networking events, to get their car serviced. Obligers depend on external accountability, with consequences such as deadlines, late fees, or the fear of letting other people down. One obliger wrote on my blog, "I don't feel a sense of accountability to my calendar, just to the people associated with the appointments. If the entry is just go for a jog, I'm not likely to do it." Another obliger summarized, "Promises made to yourself can be broken. It's the promises made to others that should never be broken." Obligers need external accountability even for activities they want to do. An obliger told me, "I never made time to read, so I joined a book group where you're really expected to read the book." Behavior that obligers sometimes attribute to self-sacrifice. Why do I always make time for other people's priorities at the expense of my own priorities? Is often better explained as need for accountability. Obligers find ingenious ways to create external accountability. One obliger explained, "I wanted to go to basketball games, but I never went. I bought season tickets with my brother, and now I go because he's annoyed if I don't show." Another said, "If I want to clean out my closet this weekend, I call a charity now to come and pick up my donations on Monday." Another obliger said, with regret, "I signed up for a photography course because I knew I needed assignments and deadlines. I took several classes, then thought, I love it, so I don't need to take a class. Guess how many photos I've taken since? One." Next semester, he's taking a class. The need to be a role model often prompts obligers to keep good habits. One obliger friend eats vegetables only when his children can see him. And another told me, "I knew I'd never practice piano, so I waited until my kids could take lessons. And now we do it together. And I have to practice, because if I don't, they won't." Obligers can sometimes do things for the sake of others that they couldn't do for themselves. Several obligers told me, practically in the same words, "If it weren't for the children, I'd still be stuck in a bad marriage. I had to get the divorce for my kids." The weight of outer expectations can make obligers susceptible to burnout because they have trouble telling people no. An obliger explained, "I drop everything to proofread my colleagues' reports, but I'm terrible about making time to finish my own reports." Obligers may find it difficult to form a habit because often we undertake habits for our own benefit, and obligers do things more easily for others than for themselves. For them, the key is external accountability. Rebels. Rebels resist all expectations, outer and inner alike. They choose to act from a sense of choice, of freedom. Rebels wake up and think, "What do I want to do today?" They resist control, even self-control, and enjoy flouting rules and expectations. Rebels work toward their own goals in their own way, and while they refuse to do what they're supposed to do, they can accomplish their own aims. One rebel told me, "My master's thesis was 10 pages shorter than recommended, and I convinced the department to add an unconventional advisor to my panel. So I got it done and did well on it, but on my terms." Rebels place a high value on authenticity and self-determination and bring an unshackled spirit to what they do. A rebel commented, "I do the assignment I want to complete rather than the one assigned. The problem comes when there's something I'm expected to do regularly, like running weekly quality checks, and therefore I just can't. At times, the rebel resistance to authority is enormously valuable to society. As one questioner pointed out, the rebel's best asset is their voice of dissent. We shouldn't try to school it out of them, or corporate culture it out, or shame it out. It's there to protect us all. But rebels often frustrate others because they can't be asked or told to do anything. They don't care if people are counting on you. You said you'd do it. Your parents will be upset. It's against the rules. This is the deadline. Or it's rude. In fact, asking or telling rebels to do something often makes them do just the opposite. A rebel wrote, "Being told or expected to do something creates a stop sensation that I have to actively overcome. If I'm asked to empty the dishwasher, my brain says, well, I was going to, but now you went and asked, so I can't, so no." The people around rebels must guard against accidentally igniting their spirit of opposition, particularly challenging for the parents of rebel children. One parent explained, "The best way to wrangle the rebel child is to give the kid the information to make a decision. Present the issue as a question that he alone can answer, and let him make a decision and act without telling you. Let him make a decision without an audience. Audiences equal expectations. If he thinks you're not watching, he won't need to rebel against your expectations." Another parent, "My rebel son got expelled and didn't want to work toward a career, though he's very smart. When he turned 18, we gave him an around-the-world plane ticket and said, 'Over to you.' He traveled for 3 years, and now he's in grad school and doing very well." Rebels sometimes frustrate even themselves because they can't tell themselves what to do. Writer John Gardner observed, "My compulsion not to do what people tell me makes me change places of living or change my life in one way or another, which often makes me very unhappy. I wish I could just settle down." On the other hand, rebels can be skillful at channeling their rebel energy in constructive ways. A rebel who wants to stick to a budget might say, "I won't be manipulated by marketers trying to sell me junk." Or a rebel who wants to succeed in school might say, "No one thinks I can get into a good college, but I'll show them." Rebels often gravitate toward work with a Wild West element, such as my rebel friend who works in disruptive technology. Not just any technology, he's careful to emphasize, but disruptive technology. Rebels resist hierarchies and rules, and they often work better with others when they're in charge. However, the opposite of a profound truth is also true. And surprisingly, some rebels gravitate to institutions with many rules. As one commenter noted, letting others have control can bring freedom as well. You'd probably find more rebels in the military than you'd suspect. Another rebel noted, "Perhaps rebels need a boundary to bend, flex, and break. Left to my own devices, I become restless and unproductive because there are no rules to break or no to-do list, which at the end of the day I look at and think, hooray, I didn't do any of those things." Anytime I speak about the tendencies, I ask people to raise their hands to indicate their category. I was surprised when a group of Christian ministers had an unusually high percentage of rebels. A rebel clergy member explained, "Clergy think of themselves as called and therefore different. They have the blessing of their colleagues, congregation, and God, which sets them above many things in life, including rules." No surprise, rebels resist habits. I met a woman who was, I immediately realized, a rebel. I asked, "Don't you find it exhausting to make choices every single day?" "No," she answered, "making choices makes me feel free." "I give myself limits to give myself freedom," I told her. She shook her head. "Freedom means no limits. To me, a life controlled by habits sounds dead." Rebels resist habits, but they can embrace habit-like behaviors by tying their actions to their choices. A rebel explained, if I have to do something every day, it guarantees I won't do it. But if I take it one day at a time and decide I'll do it this time, then more often than not, I end up with a streak. Most people, by a huge margin, are questioners or obligers. Very few are rebels, and to my astonishment, I discovered that the upholder category is also tiny. In fact, because upholders and rebels are such small categories, people who try to shape people's habits on a large scale, employers, device manufacturers, insurance companies, instructors, do better to focus on solutions that help questioners by providing sound reasons and obligers by providing accountability. We often learn most about ourselves by learning about other people. And when I began my habits research, I assumed that I was pretty average. I feel pretty average. So it was a shock to realize that as an upholder, I'm actually an extreme and rare type of personality. I mentioned my surprise to my husband, Jamie, who said, "Of course you have an extreme personality. I could have told you that." "Really?" I said. "How did you know?" "I've been married to you for 18 years. Novelist Jean Rhys observed, "One is born either to go with or to go against." From what I've observed, our tendencies are hardwired, and while they can be offset to some degree, they can't be changed. While it's often difficult to identify a child's tendency, I still can't figure out the tendencies of my two daughters. By adulthood, most people fall into a tendency that shapes their perception and behavior in a fundamental way. Yet whatever our tendency, with greater experience and wisdom, we can learn to counterbalance its negative aspects. As an upholder, for instance, I've learned to resist my inclination to meet an expectation unthinkingly and to ask, why am I meeting this expectation anyway? Being married to a questioner has helped me learn to question more myself, or I rely on Jamie to question for me. One night we were at the theater, and at intermission I told him, "So far, I really do not like this play." Jamie replied, "I don't either. Let's go home." I thought, "What? Can we just go?" And we did. My first instinct is to do what's expected of me, but when Jamie scoffs, "Nah, you don't have to do that," it's easier for me to decide, "That's right, I don't have to do that." For his part, I think Jamie has become more of an upholder over the years, at least at home. Although he's inclined to meet my requests with questions, "Why do I have to do that? What's the point? Can't I do that later?" he's learned that I always have a reason for a request, and it bugs me to have to spell it out. He's improved, somewhat, at accepting my expectations without prolonged debate. Knowing our tendency can help us frame habits in a compelling way. I exercise regularly because it's on my to-do list. A questioner rattles off the health benefits of exercise. An obliger takes a weekly bike ride with a partner. And when my rebel friend Leslie Fandrich wrote about how she started running, she emphasized rebel values of freedom and desire. Running seems like the most efficient and independent way to get myself back into shape. I can go when it suits my schedule without having to pay for a gym membership. I also love getting outside for some fresh air, and it's a great way to listen to new music. The four tendencies can provide valuable guidance to anyone trying to help others change. A boss trying to help employees to be more productive, or a healthcare provider trying to prod people to take their medication, or a consultant, coach, trainer, or therapist trying to help people achieve their aims. If we're trying to persuade people to adopt a habit, we have more success if we consider their tendency. For example, a questioner may present an obliger with sound reasons for taking an action. But those logical arguments don't matter nearly as much to an obliger as external accountability. An upholder can lecture a questioner on obligation and make a questioner less likely to meet an expectation, because questioners question all obligations. A friend told me her strategy when her rebel father's doctor prescribed a medication. The doctor went on about how important it was to take the medicine. "I know better than to tell my father what to do." So afterward, when he said, What do you think? Should I take it? I said, I wouldn't worry about it. He said, what? You want me to die? And he takes it. For the most part, although they may regret the downsides, upholders, questioners, and rebels tend to embrace their category.